Michael Horvitz is a 1975 graduate of the law school and a member of the Board of Trustees of the Law School Foundation, and was a member of the Campaign Executive Committee for the law school's recent capital campaign. He is one of our most loyal alumni. I've had the pleasure of knowing Dan since we were both law students. He is a genuine Renaissance man, and not only by virtue of his love of Italy and its culture. As a Yale undergraduate, he triple majored in mathematics, English, and an interdisciplinary program in history, arts, and letters. He then studied Shakespeare at Oxford as a Marshall Scholar before returning to Yale for law school. After law school, he clerked for then Judge Stephen Breyer on the First Circuit and for Justice Lewis Powell. We were fortunate to attract Dan to Virginia, where he has spent his professional career apart from visiting stints. As you might expect from his academic background, Dan's intellectual interests are not easy to pigeonhole. He has written about employment discrimination, family law, administrative law, and political theory, among others. But he has become one of the best-known scholars in the nation on the topic of election law. Recently, Dan wrote about the Supreme Court's use of a structural rather than an individualist interpretation of the First Amendment's expression clauses. The structural interpretation treats the First Amendment as serving principally the public's interest in broad debate and the airing of all views, rather than the individual's interest in self-expression. Dan argues that this use is an important reason for the confused and contentious state of the Supreme Court's campaign finance jurisprudence. He notes that the court applied a structural analysis in drawing the line between campaign contributions, which may be limited, and independent expenditures, which may not, in Buckley against Vallejo. The court drew two structural distinctions having to do with the appearance of corruption and the dissemination of political ideas. Dan contends that the court's failure to ground its reasoning in a readily available alternative analysis of the individual's interest in political expression is part of the reason that Buckley and the contribution independent expenditure distinction remain so hotly contested. The court also used structural arguments in Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce, and then again with it when it overruled Austin in the Citizens United case, a clear demonstration that the structural approach does not give a determinate answer to the question of corporate political speech. Dan argues again that an individualist approach gives a clearer answer to the issue whether corporate expenditures may be regulated. Corporations, unions, nonprofits, and other organizations, in Dan's view, are outside the scope of the First Amendment's core concern with individual self-expression. Dan has also written perceptively and subtly on the evolution of the Supreme Court's doctrine on electoral districts and gerrymandering. Its early approach, associated with Justice Frankfurter, was to recognize that there is more than one theory of democratic representation, and therefore to uphold a state's districting scheme so long as the state asserted that it was grounded in some theory. Dan notes the downside of this approach. It allows pretextual justifications for decisions that may have actually been intended to dilute the political influence of particular groups of voters. Justice Stewart later suggested an approach in which the court would ask whether the asserted theory of representation was rationally related to the means chosen, and whether those means had other adverse effects, such as diluting the votes of minority citizens. It seems unlikely, however, that the courts could effectively administer Stewart's approach, and it did not command a majority. This much is old news. Dan's fascinating insight is that the court's ultimate adoption of a one-person, one-vote standard was shaped by its prior attempts to solve the conundrum that there is more than one legitimate theory of democratic representation. The court ultimately selected from among the plausible theories the one that courts can easily administer. Dan argues that this is important when we get to gerrymandering. One person, one vote did not enshrine a single theory of democratic representation as being the best or most correct. Rather, it concluded that in a particular setting, it had the right mix of validity and administrability. So when we get to gerrymandering, we are on a clean slate where there is again more than one legitimate theory of representation. Should we maximize the competitiveness of each individual district or the competitiveness of the control of the legislature as a whole? but merely recognizing that there are multiple theories and deferring entirely to the legislature again allows for pretext. So, Dan argues, the court is still searching for what it found in Reynolds versus Sims, a test that is based on a plausible and widely held theory of representation and that can be administered by the courts. I note these as examples of what Dan does so well. He moves vertically back and forth between theory and doctrine as aptly and insightfully as any scholar I know. His work is always informed by political theory and empirical evidence, but he brings those to bear to try to understand what courts are doing and how they may find their way out of the many blind alleys they inevitably encounter. And he sometimes does so not just as a scholar, but as a formidable appellate advocate who most recently has argued several cases on behalf of the law school's Supreme Court Litigation Clinic, of which Dan was the brainchild, which was Dan's brainchild, excuse me. Dan will talk to us today about democracy as consumption, and I anticipate that he will show us that there is more than one plausible theory of democratic participation worth our attention. Please join me in welcoming the Michael J. and Jane R. Horvitz Distinguished Professor of Law, Dan Ortiz.
I want to thank you all for coming in on such a wonderful autumnal day. It's in the nature of these kinds of events that they're celebrations, not celebrations of the speakers. We're just the sort of temporary occasional celebrants for the occasion, but a celebration of the institution and in particular those people like the Horvitzes who are general stewards for its future success. But it also is a celebration of us, and that's what I hope to convey today. Now, what you're getting is the first rollout and sort of testing, kicking a little bit of the tires, of what may become a book-length project. It's still in its very early stages. It builds a little on some things some of you will recognize and some things that I've done before. But it wants to go in some other new directions and apply some of the same reasoning to areas where I haven't actually looked before. Now, today, what you'll do is you'll get the basic theoretical move, which is democracy as consumption, and a description of how it conflicts with what I think is the more traditional and comforting view. And then you'll get a close analysis of how this new view actually has some traction in at least one area of election law, and that will be campaign finance. Then, time permitting, I'll gesture a little to other election law issues where it might have some effect. These areas are still largely to be explored. And perhaps more interestingly to this group, its possible implications outside of election law in the law and politics more generally. Now, just one caution. Today, when I'm talking, I'm going to be talking mostly descriptively rather than prescriptively, just because this is the first rollout and the normative issues are, of course, much more fraught than the descriptive ones. I do expect the ultimate book, if it arises out of this project, however, to wrestle with normative underpinnings fairly seriously. And in fact, for me, a lot of the fun will be there. So let's sort of talk about the standard picture, what you might say the received wisdom is sort of democratic theory. And that's this picture right here. Fortunately, it's not like a classroom where I have the monitor behind me and I can actually see well what's going on, so I might have to step aside for some of these things. But basically, under what you might call the standard picture, the citizen, the voter, is the principal, is actually at the center of the picture, controlling all the decisions through intermediaries. The representatives, the political representatives, are agents who are responsible to the principal, should follow the principal's wishes. And people like bureaucrats are sub-agents of the people who follow the instructions that come from the principal's agents, the political representatives. Now, seen this way, the political process basically works to aggregate individual preferences into a single choice. What at its heart, it's the voter citizens who produce policy. They are the policy makers here, not the policy takers. Of course, at the end, as sort of loop shows, they end up taking a bit, but it's stuff they're taking from themselves in a way. It's something they themselves have made or created. Now, often there's going to be some slippage, to be sure. We're all familiar with agency cost analysis. Sometimes the agents are going to slack. They're going to pursue their own self-interest at the expense of their principals. The principals are going to have to spend some time, some money, monitoring the agents, time and money that they could better spend in directly productive activity, but has to be spent sort of superintending the behavior of the agents. But in general, despite a few perhaps even spectacular examples of misbehavior now and then, some of which are comic and some of which are just plain tragic, we're content that the picture works tolerably well. Not perfect, to be sure, but well enough to so it can be said that we should obey the law because in some sense we sort of made it ourselves, okay, despite all the slippage that's in the picture. Now, we see this picture, this is a very comforting picture and a very traditional one, one that's very powerful to us as a political culture. It is, in fact, part of the foundation of our political belief. You can see this, of course, in the beginning words of the Constitution. We, the people, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Some of the other highlights, like Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, that this nation, which concludes resoundingly, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and a government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. We also have some contemporary examples of it that show how it continues to animate our political culture. To some, these may be sort of sad, degraded images of it. Take your political pick, the Tea Party on the one hand, or Occupy on the other, but they all go back to the same foundational belief. In the sense, we ourselves have created our own politics. We are the makers, not the takers. Now, there are some problems that a lot of people have noticed with this. First, there's this embarrassment of all these other players in the political arena. It's like corporations, like unions, political parties, NGOs, lots of other people, and they have to be explained. Now, they can be explained in ways which reinforce the typical picture, if you will. Sam Zakharoff and I, many years ago, wrote an article called Governing Through Intermediaries. It tried to explain in the traditional agency cost, and under traditional agency cost analysis, how, what kind of role all these other players could be served. So many of them, like political parties, for example, could be characterized as so-called super agents, entities which actually help the principal regulate the behavior, monitor the behavior, and provide coercive sanctions, rewards, whatever, to get the ultimate agents, the political representatives, to behave the way they should. I think, though, I haven't spoken to Sam recently on this, the picture became more and more complicated because it became clear that these players were actually doing some other stuff as well, although they might have been doing some of that traditional agency superintending. And at least personally, I began to get to the problem that I thought I was like those astronomers in like the 14th century who were trying to explain how Ptolemaic astronomy could actually explain the world if you kept putting on epicycles and epicycles and you could understand the retrograde motion of Mars and things like that. And it's just becoming so complicated that at some point, as Kuhn has said, the picture just collapsed of its own weight and a new paradigm rose up in its place. Okay. I think we're at the point where we need to take another look. Now, another problem with this picture is what you might call the paradox of mass democracy. Or maybe it's not a paradox so much as a kind of impossibility situation. If you believe, as I think many people do, that democracy rests on three conditions. One, a relatively wide franchise, and it's historically, it's really just compared to other systems around at the time. So, in say the Greek polis, for example, not all that many people had the right to vote, but compared to a lot of other political cultures, they certainly did. So, wide franchise, a rough degree of equality among those who were allowed to participate, and a certain degree of political thoughtfulness. This is not buying into a belief that democracy has to be deliberative. I'm very suspicious of that. But even if people are very traditional, wholehearted interest group pluralists, that they are thinking enough to at least recognize what's in their own self-interest and what are the best means through the ballot box to try to effectuate that self-interest. Now, the paradox, which was originally, I think, laid out by Anthony Downs in his 1957 book, An Economic Theory of Democracy, basically pointed to a kind of tension, conflict that was almost intractable between the first and the third tradition. The wider democracy is, the less economic reason people have to know anything about it, to inform themselves, because, a simple point, the chances that their vote, their own political decision, will make any difference to the outcome is vanishingly small. If that's true, why should I invest any effort in information, trying to figure things out? So Downs basically said, we've got this problem. As democracy has expanded, gone beyond the palace, the Greek polis or the New Hampshire town meeting, people become less and less and less informed. And this is particularly a problem because people's political choices have externalities. If I make a dumb decision at the grocery store, I'm the only one who's going to have to eat it, right? I suffer the consequences. If I make a very dumb decision at the ballot box, I'm not the only one who has to live with it. All the other people who live in the jurisdiction with me have to worry about it as well. Okay. So this is based on this idea of sort of rational ignorance, that ignorance in politics in the voter is not a sign that the voter is somehow not doing his or her job. It's the rational thing, way for the voter to behave. And that this is an intractable problem at the center of politics, because at least classical democratic theory demands much of the citizen voter. But economic theories will tell you they don't have any kind of sense. It's irrational for them to actually live up to it. So what point this is just a central problem. Now, for example, try to give you some data here, since Paul so kindly argued that I like to work both between the empirical and the theoretical. Try to show you how, what the extent of this problem is. So this data is a little bit stale, but still about the best I could find. And it's asked trying to come up and find out how many Americans, what percentage of the American electorate, I believe this is a voting age citizen, not necessarily registered voters, are able to answer some simple questions either about politics, institutions, or basic cultural knowledge that might be a proxy for knowing other kinds of things that you want to know in making astute political decisions. So maybe at this point we should sort of turn it over to Family Feud, the kind of Family Feud format. I was expecting an audience was a little less longer than teeth. It's always wonderful to have my colleagues here. But I thought at this point it would be fun to sort of test the students. So, for example, a question was asked in, most of these come originally from the Roper organization. You know, basically, what is the Electoral College? To test Americans' understanding of what it is. And it turned out that 35% of the people could describe basically, this is not like exactly, you know, how many votes each state gets or what happens if the presidential election is thrown into the House of Representatives. None of that stuff, just the basics. 35% recognized what it was and were able to give a kind of simple explanation of how it functioned. What is the length of a House term? People asked this, 30% answered correctly. When asked to name two branches, two of government, what do you think? 27% of the citizenry basically answered correctly. Name two First Amendment rights, 20% answered correctly. And very bad news for those of you who are interested in either criminal procedure, due process, or property rights. When asked to name two Fifth Amendment rights, 2% of the populace was able to rise to the occasion. Okay? Now, let's not even talk about geography, although it's often been pointed out that geography is a kind of proxy for knowing just general things about your own culture. When asked to locate New York State on the map, 55% people could do it. Missouri, sorry, Paul, Only 45% could do it. United Kingdom, island nation somewhere off coast of Europe, 57, I was actually surprised by that, could do it given the other numbers. Poland, okay, 28%. And God forbid you should ask people where Romania is, although I can understand that you get 11%. Now, this, I guess, does prove the wisdom of Ambrose Bierce's adage that war is God's way of teaching Americans geography, right? When some of you really care about something, you go find out about it. Although it was a little bit, I did look at one Roper survey from the summer and was surprised to find that a surprisingly few people could locate, Americans could locate Egypt on a map after all the stuff that had been happening in Egypt. Now, when it comes to political knowledge, I want to sort of give you a baseline here, and actually here the age of this audience might help. Just establish some general baselines. This is stuff you sort of think for trivial, so you can actually get an idea of where people sort of stand on sort of general knowledge about political figures and things like that, and then go to stuff that maybe is a little bit more substantive. The name of this is, and this is not testing you now, but this was a question that came, was from 1992, before the election, okay, between Clinton and George H.W. Bush. The name of George H.W. Bush's dog. First, does anyone remember? Millie, great. Okay, you got a gold star, Julia. What percent of the people, of Americans at the time, do you think knew Millie's name? 86%. The name of the television character criticized by Dan Quayle. You remember, Julia? Murphy Brown, okay. 89%. When asked, would Bush or Clinton work to end the death penalty? What do you think? What percentage of people answered that correctly? You know, slightly more substantive question. Oh, maybe only slightly. 60? Any other opinions? I won't cold call. You don't have to worry about that. 15%. Asked, who would cut capital gains taxes? 5%. Okay. So, if nothing else, I want to suggest we might possibly have a little bit to worry about. Now, the interesting thing to me is that this is a problem that's been recognized from the beginning, in a way. Now, we always celebrate the founders. James Madison's name comes out. We pull out the pom-poms, stuff like that. But if you actually read the Federalist Papers, in particular, and some other writings at the time, although the terminology they used was a little bit different, they were actually critically concerned about this problem and went so far as to design our primary political institutions to address it. So, for example, in Federalist No. 10, which we all remember for other reasons, Madison actually talked a lot about the superiority of republics to democracies. You have to have representation because you have to have public opinion filtered through this lens of the opinion of people who actually are capable of understanding things. You have the Senate and the House of Representatives. Of course, the House of Representatives is supposed to represent popular will, but you wouldn't want that all by itself. You want a counterweight. The Senate, the sort of wiser sages to actually think differently about the same kind of issues. The Electoral College, well, God forbid that you should actually trust people on the street to vote directly for president. Can't have that. And of course, there was a lot of existing, what you might call existing political furniture, which was in the picture, which people relied on to address the same problem. Nowadays, many of them are distasteful, but at the time, property qualifications were thought of in large part as a way of making sure that the people who voted had the stake to actually care about things. Nowadays, people tend to have the response that what we should do is build voters up. If they fall short of the demands of classical democracy, we'll make them better, kind of thing. Educate them more, or during electoral campaigns, someone should just pay to push more information to them. Now, I'm very suspicious of these kinds of approaches because I think fundamentally they're misguided. They're not going to really do anything. Because at bottom, if you believe what the explanation of the problem, it's a demand, not a supply problem. It's not that people are making all these, are politically ignorant because the information isn't available. It's because it doesn't make sense for them to invest any time and effort in finding it out. And just throwing more information at people isn't going to make that better. In fact, if anything, it might make it worse, just by confusing them even more. Now, a lot of other people have tried to respond by saying, well, this is all true, okay? But be happy, don't worry. Low information voting is good enough. Voters can follow simple cues. Who's a Democrat? Who's a Republican? That kind of thing. Well enough to maintain the traditional picture. Or even if they can't do that very well, voters can make decisions retrospectively. They're unhappy, they can punish by throwing particular bums out and putting new bums in. And that politicians will, their agents, will internalize that threat when they're making decisions. So they'll constantly be under the leash of voters. And that will operate to make sure the whole thing works. But in the face of the degree of political ignorance, you wonder if that's really true. For example, for the retrospective voting business to work, voters must have a pretty good idea of who's responsible. But it's often, if you look at these other political surveys, except in very unusual times, voters will have very little awareness of, say, who's in control of the Senate or the House of Representatives. Okay? Now, literally the last few weeks may be atypical, but in general, that's true. Okay? Now, what I want to put forward is this different picture, this different model, which is democracy as consumption. The old paradigm is democracy as production. People are makers, the voters are making the policy. I want to invert that picture and see how well, since this is mostly a descriptive talk right now, how well it describes bits of the legal framework. So under this democracy as consumption picture, it's a little bit hybrid, but basically we embrace the traditional picture as much as we can. Meaning when we see it, when people are really doing things, participating in politics, thinking about politics, we applaud and push them on, say more, more, more. Then, when we're beyond that, we economize on voter attention as much as possible. We recognize that it only makes so much sense for them to worry so much, and we try to redesign political choices, the political structures, to economize on the amount of attention that we actually have. And then after that, we don't quite throw up our hands, but we admit we can only do so much, and then we try hard to make people better consumers. Okay. Now, campaign finance, I want to explain the campaign finance architecture. Well, let me talk about some of the difficulties first about this new picture and why it may bother people. Notice what it does. Although it holds on to a little bit of the standard paradigm, it actually restructures, it tries to restructure political decision making so that people will pay more attention. There's a cost to that, however. You're moving political production away from the voter to other people, largely political parties, representatives, people like that. So all of a sudden, under the new picture, the traditional sovereignty of the voter is a little bit, at least, undercut. The agents, the people who were meant to serve before, now in an odd way, become the producers, right? And the people who were meant to be served, the producers, now become the consumers. So all the parts of the picture are completely rejumbled, and the person who is at the center, the voter, is now, in a sense, at the margin. The real action is somewhere else. So the people who were policymakers have, in some sense, become policy takers. Now, and imagine how frightening this will be to some, just if I had retitled the talk, said democracy is consumption, something like democracy is shopping, right? Can't have that. It's insulting to people. But beyond its being insulting, it's troubling for a very different reason, in that the traditional legitimation story becomes difficult and somewhat uncertain. No longer can we say to ourselves, I am bound to follow the law because in some sense I made it. Now we have to say, well, I'm bound to follow the law because something like the invisible hand of the market told me right there and told me this was right. That's troubling. And actually, when this goes more normative, that's a bit I'm really, really, really dying to explore. Okay. Now, Let's actually talk about one piece of one area of law which I spent a little bit of time with and probably many people know a little bit about, campaign finance, and try to talk about how it, I think, exhibits, or at least at one time, exhibited some of the characteristics of democracy as consumption. Again, this is a descriptive move. So, for example, look at the central architecture of American campaign finance regulation on a federal level before Citizens United. Basically, there's a distinction between giving money versus giving personal time and energy. This bothered a lot of people. Someone like Rupert Murdoch could say, well, why can Barbara Streisand give all of her talent, have a concert for someone, and, you know, I'm a bad singer, but I can give the same amount of money. Why can't I do that? Why is she allowed to participate and I'm not? And people really didn't have a very good answer to that. You'll say, well, in the end, she's participating to raise money for the party or the candidate or whatever. Why is that different? This was thought to be a powerful criticism in many people's minds of the existing campaign finance regime. But, again, a pretty central and undisturbed part of it. Another bit is this thing that Paul talked about in introducing me, the distinction between contributions and independent expenditures. People said, money is money. What's the difference between my contributing something, giving money over to someone else for them to decide how to use, rather than spending that money myself directly on something? Third, there was disclosure was often required for what you might call impersonal spending. If I give money to someone or if I'm just sort of spending it even my own behalf for an ad for a political candidate. But the law was much more protective of what you might call direct personal spending. Someone on a local level paying for handbills to distribute to people before a school board election. And there's a case where McIntyre said, no, the government can't require disclosure there. And then people said, well, you said in McIntyre you can't require disclosure. Some of the same reasons would seem to apply to this other stuff. And the courts say, no, that's different, without ever really well explaining why. Also, it was clear, although corporations could be regulated in ways that individuals couldn't, corporations, for example, were banned from contributing to candidates and banned from making express advocacy on candidates' behalf, that media corporations were cut some slack. And in particular, their press and editorial functions were pretty much exempt. So the New York Times could spend money to run an editorial saying, vote for one candidate or another, but GM really couldn't. Okay. And then in BICRA, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002, so-called McCain-Feingold, there was another innovation put in, which I think disturbed a lot of people, was struck down in Citizens United. In fact, was a central thing that was struck down in Citizens United, which I think you can also explain in terms of this typology. This is a so-called electioneering communications provision. What happened was that Congress passed a law saying that corporations could not only not spend money from their general treasuries supplied to unions too, to say things like vote for candidate X, vote against candidate Y, that kind of stuff. But because those rules were so easy to circumvent, just by not using the so-called magic words of vote for, vote against, that kind of stuff, they went broader and defined a category of speech called electioneering communications, which basically had four conditions. One, it covers anything, it's defined as any broadcast cable or satellite communication that is publicly distributed. That meant typically that it could reach at least 50,000 people in the jurisdiction, and refers to a clearly identified candidate for public office, means mentions a name or has a picture or anything like that, and is made within 30 days of a primary or 60 days of a general election. Individuals could engage in such speech. They just had to disclose the amount of money they were spending and on whose behalf. But so-called non-ideological corporations and unions couldn't engage in this kind of speech if they were paying for the speech out of their general treasury funds. Now note what this, go back for a minute, how this maps on to some of the democracy as consumption condition for all of these. Okay. First, giving money versus giving personal time and energy. Remember I said the first thing that defined it was if you find people actually doing things, participating in politics, you want to encourage that. Okay, individuals. Okay. So I think this is a way of saying that giving money isn't really by its nature as central to what we could think of as political participation is actually walking around, knocking on doors, singing on someone's behalf, doing that kind of stuff. For the law, culturally, that's our intuition. Okay? The contribution expenditure distinction rests in part, I mean, it's very contested, it's a very murky distinction, the rationale for it is very different, but part of it has to rest in this idea, I think, that if I'm contributing to someone, I'm giving up control of how the money is actually spent. I'm not really making decisions about how it's used on the ground. But if I'm actually making an expenditure, I am making those decisions myself. And that somehow is more praiseworthy than the other. This disclosure of impersonal spending, but not of direct personal spending, again, we want to encourage people in the school board elections. But if someone is just handing money over to a political committee, candidate committee or something like that, well, it's fine to disclose it. That's, in a sense, less participatory. And the press, news, and editorial functions exemption, again, we look at some media differently than other media, or some kinds of speech. We look at an editorial in the New York Times or the Daily News or the Sun or whatever differently than an ad on television, meaning we think that people may think about it differently, not that they'll necessarily be persuaded by it, but at least register differently. First, there won't be a lot of affect to perhaps distract their attention, and that, you know, these kinds of things cause people to think about their decisions a bit differently. Now, when we get to electioneering communications, I want to suggest it's the same sort of thing. Notice what is not covered. It covers any broadcast, cable, or satellite communication. It doesn't cover things like emails, doesn't cover prints, doesn't cover letters, doesn't cover signs, all this other kind of stuff. The authors or the creators of the provision thought in part that some ways of communicating were, I think, more thoughtful than others. And you could economize an attention or promote that by, in a sense, refunneling corporate, this kind of corporate and union spending away from the big, the traditional television ads into these other ways of communication. This public distributed, meaning that they didn't want this law to touch individual emails, things like that. Refers to a clearly identified candidate, that is made within 30 days of primary or 60 days of the general election. There's a kind of worry that only within this kind of window, when people were more likely to be wrestling with political choices, you wanted to be specially concerned about the quality of their decision making. So again, I want to suggest this actually fits a little bit of the picture of what was going on under democracy is consumption. Now, Citizens United, big case, everyone's heard of it. Only a few things you need to know about why what it was doing was an issue. Citizens United was an ideological corporation, so by itself, it wouldn't actually have been covered by the communications, the electioneering communications provision. But it accepted contributions from regular business corporations, and that brought it under coverage. Now, Citizens United released this video, 90-minute video, Hillary the Movie in Theaters, now on DVD, and also wanted to make it available as well through video on demand. Now, note that releasing this thing in theaters caused no problem under the statute, because that wasn't satellite, cable, television broadcast, and DVD didn't cause any problem. The only thing that caused a problem was this video on demand, which interestingly, and this was a problem with the statute, I think wasn't even thought about by the people who wrote this part of McCain-Feingold, because technology then was such that it wasn't, this is such a minor part of the picture that no one was concerned. Now, Citizens United wanted this video and some ads for it to be available within 30 days of primary elections through all these three channels of distribution. But again, it was only the video on demand that was problematic at all under the statute. Hillary Clinton, running against a guy who's now president in 2008, in the Democratic primary, and this was the video.
Senator Clinton is claiming basically the entire 8 years of the Clinton presidency as her own, except for the stuff that didn't work out, in which case she says she has nothing to do with it.
She makes herself sound like she has diplomatic experience, like she has managerial experience, as if she has policy development experience. She doesn't have any of those things.
She does not answer questions
straight out.
I did not say that it should be done.
You said yes. No. You thought it made sense to do it.
No, I didn't, Chris. But the point is, what are we going to do with all these illegal immigrants?
Unless I missed something, Senator Clinton said two different things in the course of about 2 minutes.
She's driven by the power. She's driven to get the power. That is the driving force in her life.
She is steeped in controversy, steeped in sleaze. That's why they don't want us to look at her record.
Well, I think it's worth remembering. After her health care fiasco, the Clinton team put us aside.
I mean, certainly you have to ask whether or not she's learned a lot from that experience. It was a failure. She knows it was a failure. It was a very embarrassing failure for her.
She's a person who's struggling herself with figuring out who she is, or more importantly, how she wants to present herself to the American public.
She's deceitful. She'll make up any story, lie about anything, as long as it serves her purpose of the moment. And the American people are going to catch on to it.
I can't think of any other politician in history who has shown such a disrespect and a contempt for the Constitution and the rule of law as Hillary. And I represented Richard Nixon's best friend, and I knew Richard Nixon. And I'll tell you something, she's no Richard Nixon, she's worse.
Ruthless, vindictive,
venal, sneaky,
ideological, intolerant.
Liar is a good one.
Scares the hell out of me.
I'm sick and tired of people who say that if you debate and you disagree with this administration, somehow you're not patriotic, and we should stand up and say we are Americans and we have a right to debate and disagree with any administration.
I thought I'd save you from the full 90 minutes. So this is just the little 2.5 minute teaser. But you should get an idea of what the video was all about. Certainly, no. Political speech well within the ambit of the First Amendment. So the court actually had to figure out what to do with it. And it made several moves which very quickly made it clear that corporations were to be treated pretty much as individuals here. Conceptualized corporations as expressive associations as citizens. No longer was corporation the nexus of contracts that FAMA made so famous, but instead just a collection of citizens here. See, if the First Amendment is any force that prohibits Congress from fining or jailing citizens or associations of citizens for simply engaging in political speech. Ricker would, however, permit the government to ban political speech simply because the speaker is an association of citizens. That has taken on the corporate form. Later, BICRA permits the government to ban the political speech of millions of associations of citizens. And under BICRA, certain disfavored associations of citizens, those that have taken on the corporate form, are penalized for engaging in the same political speech. Okay. So second part of the move, which is not, not surprising in First Amendment law, is that although the First Amendment protects the right to speech, we actually often read and interpret it from the perspective of the listener. In other words, we protect speakers in order to really protect the listener's view here. And the court took this move on it. Again, is not, which is completely fair. The government has muffled the voices that best represent the most significant segments of the economy, and the electorate has been deprived of information, knowledge, and opinion vital to its function. Okay. Notice now who, because of this move, is becoming the center of attention. Not the corporation, it's the voter. And even before, under the first move, the corporation had some independent right of speech as opposed to the voter's right to hear, because the corporation itself represented an agglomeration of individual citizens. And by suppressing the speech of manifold corporations, the government prevents their voices and viewpoints from reaching the public and advising voters on which persons or entities are hostile to their interests. Factions should be checked by permitting them all to speak and by entrusting the people to judge what is true and what is false. So again, it's this kind of citizen-centered notion of sovereignty. It's more, I think, the traditional view, but we'll see that, I think, more clearly in a moment. So what's left doctrinally in this area? Citizens United formally upholds the contribution independent expenditure distinction, but allows corporations and unions to make expenditures basically on the same basis as individuals can. So he abolishes the press exemption as a constitutional matter by saying all corporations have to be treated the same. It's kind of equal protection rationale. You can't treat New York Times differently than General Motors. And the Citizens United uphold disclosure requirements, perhaps a little surprisingly, and to Justice Thomas's great discomfort, without putting pressure on the so-called McIntyre exception, which is this thing, you know, when people are paying for handbills to distribute at school board elections, they can preserve their anonymity. Now, think whether these views are production or consumption. Think fairly clearly that what you sort of see in Citizens United is a move away from the regime before, which was, I mean, to my mind at least, this democracy is consumption model, or more in harmony with it, back to the more traditional view. This is under, they quote an opinion by Justice Douglas, joined by Warren and Black, you know, all three lions of the First Amendment, in United States versus Automobile Workers, making this point. Under our Constitution, it is, hear it, we the people who are sovereign. The people have the final say. The legislators are their spokesmen. The people determine through their votes the destiny of the nation. It is therefore important, vitally important, that all channels of communication be open to them during every election, and that no point of view be restrained or barred, and that the people have access to the views of every group in the community. Again, a refocusing or a shift back in focus on the citizen voter as the producer of all the policy. And of course, as always true, Scalia says it better. Unfortunately, he didn't say it in Citizens United. He said it in an earlier opinion, which the court overruled in Citizens United, which is Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce. There, he said, and you can sort of see the flags waving, the premise of our system is that there's no such thing as too much speech, that the people are not foolish but intelligent, and will separate the wheat from the chaff. As conceded in Lincoln's aphorism about fooling all the people some of the time, that premise will not invariably accord with reality, but will assuredly do so much more frequently than the premise that the court today embraces, that a healthy democratic system can survive the legislative power to prescribe how much political speech is too much, who may speak and who may not. Again, this kind of very strong reaffirmation of this view that the citizen is in the center calling all the shots. Interestingly, you said that's almost unchallengeable as a bit of sort of First Amendment sort of myth or story. But Justice Stevens, this is one of the few times I've actually seen this in a Supreme Court opinion, actually comes out and tries to attack that very self-flattering story of the voter. All the majority's theoretical arguments, all of them, turn on a proposition with undeniable surface appeal but little grounding in evidence or experience, that there is no such thing as too much speech. So he's actually going back to Scalia's line in the earlier opinion. If individuals in our society had infinite free time to listen to and contemplate every last bit of speech uttered by anyone, anywhere, and if broadcast advertisements had no special ability to influence elections apart from the merits of their arguments, to the extent they make any, and if legislators always operated with nothing less than perfect virtue, then I suppose the majority's premise would be sound. Okay? Certainly suggesting that he believes it's not. So to Justice Stevens' view, I think, in the end, the old regime that was thrown, that was overturned by Citizens United was defensible to the extent that it was, not on the traditional picture, but on this other opposed view, democracy is consumption. Now, very briefly, I just want to mention to you, I'm straining your patience already, I worry, other areas of election law where you could sort of try to potentially tease this conflict out. So-called voting wars, the efforts that are going on in many jurisdictions now about imposing voter ID requirements, restricting the number of days when you can register, the number of hours at polling stations, that kind of stuff. Party competition doctrine, which covers political gerrymandering, but also issues of ballot access, and issues, legal issues surrounding party autonomy. If you, for example, believe that democracy operates as consumption or should, maybe the parties, the producers, should be given more autonomy than they have now. I don't know. That's certainly something worth exploring. Other areas of law or institution making that it might have some implications for are moving some political decision making outside of politics, so that people's attention can be more focused on things that you need politics to do, because other arenas can't actually handle them. This would maybe mean hiving off certain kinds of decision-making more to markets, maybe some to agencies, maybe some to courts, with of course, some backup of allowing political overrides, basically what which we have now in some areas. Also, you want to economize more on political attentiveness. Right? Maybe you want to redesign, say, elections in Charlottesville, so we're not voting on people like the court clerk, commissioner of the revenue, people like that. No. Who knows what those people do, let alone what positions they take on any of this kind of stuff. Another move might be to think more seriously about principles of subsidiarity and localism. If we care more about some things because they matter to us locally, maybe if we move the locus of decision-making over some of those issues down to that level, people will pay more attention. They'll have at least a greater incentive to pay more attention to them. And also, as one of my new colleagues, and Andrew, has written, we might want to heighten the salience, we might think of heightening the salience of particularly important issues. If their salience is heightened, if, say, they matter to people's immediate pocketbooks, taxes, something like that, maybe people will think about them more. So I'm happy to take questions, but that's sort of the design of the overall project. And a few years from now, we may see where it ends up. But thank you for your patience today.